Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear oral arguments from the Waitar and CSR Limited versus Link.
May it please the court, Mr. Robin P. Hartman will present argument for the Waitar. The Waitar has reserved 5 minutes for the vote.
May it please the court, I represent Colonial Sugar, also known as CSR, which is the relator in this mandamus proceeding before the court. CSR is an Australian company based in Sydney. And CSR is also a recent entrant, relatively recent entrant into the Texas asbestos litigation currently pending in our state. It is CSR's view that at this late date, plaintiffs in these cases have cast their nets too widely in the continuing search for additional defendants that have not already gone bankrupt. And the jurisdiction in this case is insupportable as to CSR. I believe that there are two questions before the court this morning, and I believe that they are interrelated. The first is whether the lower court's overruling CSR's special appearance is sustainable, and the second is whether mandamus is an appropriate vehicle for us to bring the overruling of that special appearance to the attention of this court. As the court has recently made clear, the scope of permissible mandamus review is very narrow, and mandamus is reserved for only extraordinary circumstances. I would suggest to you that this is an easier case for the court than the National Sand case. I would further suggest that if there is ever a case when a company in the shoes of CSR can use mandamus to bring the denial of a personal jurisdictional challenge to this court, this is the one. And there are a number of reasons for that that I will get into with the court.
Are you advocating that we overrule any of our cases?
I'm not, Your Honor. I think this fits snugly within both the Canadian helicopters as well as following on the heels of National Sand. In the first instance, you know, when this court dealt with National Sand, you had a little bit of jurisdictional fact to deal with in that case. It wasn't much, and you found to that effect. But that was a case where the defendant challenging jurisdiction had sent newsletters into the state, had collected some dues in the state, had maybe made one visit to the state. There were a few things to talk about. What you have before you today is a total and inarguable lack of jurisdiction. I mean, think of it. The
basis. 700,000 pounds of anything? A lot?
What, one shipment, Your Honor, in 1957. One shipment of fiber by Johns Manville.
But that's when a lot of these injuries at least were set in motion that later manifested themselves.
Well, that's
asbestos
not.
Asbestos industry is in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, isn't it?
That is true. Now, none of that's been tied to this one shipment. But and to go back and give the court a little bit of a backdrop, in those early days, Johns Manville was the worldwide expert in asbestos. They had some of their own mines. They went throughout the world looking for asbestos fiber, and they came to Australia. Very little of their asbestos requirements over the years were bought from CSR, some less than 1%. But they came to Australia, and the shipment in question, 1957, they bought from us in Australia, FOB Australia. That's the sole basis before the court now for seeking to uphold jurisdiction when the claimed exposure is finished products, Your Honor. They're products that we didn't make and that we had no control over the company that made them.
How about your alleged statement to the West Virginia Supreme Court that for a state where the shipment went, you would not challenge jurisdiction?
Your Honor, that's the so-called waiver issue that's been briefed and is before the court. And frankly, I believe it's a red herring. What happened in that case is in an appellate argument in West Virginia, CSR's counsel, in an unrecorded, non-transcribed argument, is claimed to have said that CSR would not challenge jurisdiction in places where its shipments ended up. Affidavits on file deny that happened. There are affidavits on the other side. It's far from clear if you're going to talk about any kind of judicial estoppel or anything like that. A clear statement is required. But also, these Harris County cases were not on file at that time. I mean, there has to be a known relinquishment of a present right. It's unfortunately a circumstance that arose that is very cloudy, and it doesn't seem to me can be used as any kind of a basis to say that CSR agreed to become a defendant in the state of Texas.
With regards to the transaction in 1957, stating that Jonathan Manville took possession in Sydney, Australia, paid for it in Australia, got title to in Australia, and that CSR had no say-so as to the ultimate destination of the shipment.
Absolutely correct, Your Honor. And it wasn't Sydney, it was on the west coast of Australia, but title, risk of loss, all passed in Australia. What happened to the fiber?
Has that been disputed in any way?
Not at all.
Well, it's disputed in brief, because the response in this case says at least three times that CSR shipped the asbestos. Page 6, page 13, and page 15.
Justice Hegwood, with all due respect, that's sort of like trying to call a horse a cow. I mean, it just didn't happen. The record is very clear. The sale terms were FOB, title and risk of loss passed. What they're trying to say is that they're trying to tag us with what Johns Manville did.
How would you distinguish this case from those in other states where the courts have held their jurisdiction?
Your Honor, most of the courts that have looked at this have dismissed CSR, but there are some cases that are still wending their way through other state courts where jurisdiction has been upheld. The facts are all different in some of those cases. There are some states where CSR does not challenge personal jurisdiction. As an example, in California, where fiber was shipped in, plant workers were exposed, jurisdiction has not been challenged. But in a case like this, where we didn't manufacture the product, and these plaintiffs don't allege that they were exposed to a product that's tied to our fiber, it's just too tenuous. And given the facts and circumstances, it's an ideal case, and it fits within the very narrow crack in the door that this court has left for use of mandamus under these circumstances.
The super abuse of discretion?
Your Honor, I think we meet that standard. In Canadian Helicopters, there really were three bases set for using mandamus under these circumstances. Parent-child not applicable here. The circumstances where there's an inarguable absence of jurisdiction, I think we can meet. The third we haven't talked about, which is foreign affairs and comedy, which I think is another aspect that puts this case clearly within what's always been recognized as an appropriate use of mandamus to challenge the denial of a challenge to personal jurisdiction.
How is sovereign immunity involved?
Your Honor, it's not sovereign immunity. Sovereign immunity is one aspect of the foreign affairs and comedy that's always been recognized. What we have here in the record is the position of the government of Australia.
Well, they're just looking out for their commercial people, aren't they?
Well,
is there any question in this record that CSR is a private company? Is it owned or operated in any way by Australia as a state?
It is a private company, Your Honor.
So how does that argument even fly?
I guess to me...
In all the cases you see where that is an issue such as REC, that you have a sovereign entity who's objecting to the jurisdiction.
Well, to me, I guess it's a little...
I brought their viewpoint that they want to keep their private companies out of it. But how does that apply here?
We have a long and storied relationship, our country does, with Australia. And I guess...
I could think that's true with every country. But does that mean we're going to change the law?
No, Your Honor. And the government of Australia is not asking for any special favors in any respect. It's quite similar to the way our government takes a look at the way Japan deals with some of our companies. I mean, those are private companies. And all we do is we ask...
Isn't it when that happened, our government took action and said, if you don't do like we want, we're going to stop trading with you.
That's right. And all that, I think that reflects that each country has got an interest that their private companies are fairly dealt with in the foreign affairs arena. And in fact, in the brief that is part of the record in this court, the brief that was filed in the U.S. Supreme Court by the government of Australia, I think there's an interesting aspect to this case. The government talks about the Asahi case. And one of the interesting things to think about when you recall Asahi is that even though it was a fractured U.S. Supreme Court on the issue of stream of commerce and broke down and everyone's argued between Justice Brennan's concurring opinion that likes the stream of commerce theory and Justice Sandra O'Connor's opinion, which didn't allow it. But eight of those nine justices agreed with Section 2B, I believe it was, of that opinion, which talks about the foreign affairs aspects of it. And even the justices that didn't go along with the conclusion said that in the interest of foreign affairs, here they had a Japanese parts manufacturer that sold to Taiwan, that in the interest of foreign affairs, we weren't going to exercise personal jurisdiction under those circumstances, and that we're going to be cautious. I mean, this court's opinion in English China goes back along the same sort of a track. We're going to be careful when we use our long-arm possibilities when we're dealing with an alien company. And as the brief of the government of Australia points out, if this thing were flipped around and a U.S. company were faced with these kinds of claims in Australia, it would be thrown out of court. There's no such theory to hold.
If that's true, though, isn't every defendant in a case like this either a subject or a citizen of a foreign country or another state in the United States like Kansas? I mean, that would mean that mandamus would be available in every special appearance case, wouldn't it?
If you made the suggestion that it ought to go that far, I would agree, but that's not the suggestion being made here. As in Asahi and as in the English China case decided by this court, all the courts are saying is, let's take a look at this alien company from the other side of the globe in our case before we drag them into the U.S. courts. Not that we're going to give them a special benefit, but in terms of fairness and reasonableness and whether they should be called to account in our courts, we're going to take an extra hard look at it.
Mr. Harkin, in that connection, Matthews argues that this little company that you say is a foreign company has 2,800 employees in the United States, yearly sales of $510 million in the United States, and $990 million in assets in the United States, and that it markets to many, many states. So it's not really just a little foreign Australian corporation with very tenuous connections to the United States.
Your Honor, let me clear that up. I mean, the shipment we're talking about was in 1957. In the 80s, CSR made investments in the United States, and there are CSR subsidiaries that have those operations in the United States. And that's the issue that's been tried to be blurred by my opponents in this case, is to say that because CSR made, you know, acquired companies and made it in our economy, and because they do support jobs in this country, that somehow should support jurisdiction based upon this 1957 shipment of asbestos.
I want to ask you specifically about specific jurisdiction in that shipment. Is there any evidence that that specific shipment that was FOB to Houston, that your asbestos was involved in any way in the injury in this case?
Zero, Your Honor.
What about the stream of commerce argument? Argue that, first of all, let me ask you, is there any evidence in the record that your company knew knew at the time where its asbestos was going ultimately once it was incorporated into products? Did you know what products your asbestos was being used in and where those products were being distributed?
Your Honor, at that time, I mean, when the shipment was made and was delivered FOB, the purchaser had shipping instructions.
I'm not saying the allegations made that all across the United States you shipped asbestos over a period of years into the United States, that asbestos has been incorporated into products. Is there any evidence that you knew or not at the time where those products, with your product incorporated in it, were being shipped in the United States?
Not specifically, Your Honor. I mean, there were visits to the United States, and did CSR people have an idea that some products were being made, but there's no control or involvement or joint venturing of research or any of the kinds
but
of
But did you have reason to believe that your products were being shipped into Texas? Is there evidence to that effect, that you knew that a manufactured product that had your raw material in it were being shipped to Texas?
I don't think there's anything in the record to that account, Your Honor.
There is, Mr. Hartman, I know there was a reference to kind of a super abuse, but there's actually, as far as I can see, two elements on mandamus. One is it hasn't been abuse of discretion, but the other one that's not related to abuse of discretion is protection on appeal. You could find there's an abuse of discretion here, but because there's an adequacy of an appeal, you still don't get mandamus. What makes the adequacy of an appeal not viable in this case that distinguishes it from any other case where there is, inarguably, no personal jurisdiction?
Let me answer it this way. A total and inarguable absence of jurisdiction, I would suggest, leaves a defendant in an irreparable injury situation, and I believe that would justify mandamus. But there is much more in this case. For one thing, I've already talked about the foreign affairs and foreign commerce with an important ally trading partner of the United States. I think that's a substantial and a serious issue. There's another factor, too, that I think has to be part of this, and that's the reason that I see this mandamus proceeding as being like a seamless web. In Canadian Helicopters, you had a wrongful death case. I mean, that arguably could have been the type of case that could have found its way up through the court system in the normal course. What this particular company is faced with, though, is being tossed into the morass of mass tort litigation, mass tort asbestos litigation in Texas. And you know, according to the press, there's some dozen companies that have already gone bankrupt, and these companies are then in the Hobson's choice of, do they bleed to death by paying defense costs that go on, you know, forever, or do they pay claims, you know, where they think there's not jurisdiction or they think there aren't any claims? And so, I mean, I think the nature of the claim argues out, you know, for the irreparable injury this company would sustain if it's forced to defend in Texas. I also would point out that the scope of the order that was entered in Harris County, which I put that last, but it's a ruling. And, you know, this is part of the machinery that's been set up in this state for dealing with asbestos litigation. But there's an omnibus ruling that, in effect, CSR is subject to personal jurisdiction for all pending cases, for future cases that are brought, for plaintiffs we haven't even heard of, for products that we may not know anything about, all without regard to the fact that we didn't make the product. We may not have made a product, but we're going to be held liable for, you know, for personal jurisdiction in any case that happens to be filed in Harris County. Now, that sounds sort of outrageous, and I don't expect you to hear that sort of a thing if it hadn't been for the morass that we find ourselves in, I guess, in this state, and the attempts to set up mechanisms with which to deal with it. But all those I suggest, just to think, are reasons why this is as good a case as you'll find, I believe, for use of mandamus in these circumstances.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Richard N. Countess will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. As he should have, and as I expected, counsel for the opposing party tells you this is a sand case. I tell you that it is a Canadian Helicopters case. I also tell you that if Canadian Helicopters is Texas law, then this is not a mandamus proceeding.
We'd have to overrule Canadian Helicopters to grant the writ in this case, in your opinion?
That's my opinion, Justice Cornyn, yes. Now, there's no point in me lecturing this court on what Canadian Helicopters says because you know it far better. There's no point in my lecturing this court on what Canadian Helicopters says because you know it far better than I. But please remember some of the key words that the court used. You talked about a permanent loss of substantial rights. You talked about comity in foreign affairs as a possible limited exception. You talked about extraordinary circumstances. Limited, narrow circumstances. And when you finally drew what I call the Canadian Helicopters exception, you spoke in terms of a total and inarguable absence of jurisdiction and in terms of such disregard for guiding principles that the harm is irreparable. Now, those were the conditions that you drew for a mandamus and a special appearance. And if the case did not fit those it was not under Canadian Helicopters, a mandamus case.
Why is this just like National Sand, or even stronger than National Sand?
Well, first, Justice Gonzalez, and I realize you wrote National Sand, the first problem that I, in my position here today, have with National Sand is that it is a abuse of discretion analysis, but it does not contain, other than the general statement, a adequate remedy by appeal analysis. I can see in National Sand nothing that you do not see in the ordinary special appearance case. Jurisdiction was questionable. There were tenuous arguments. Depending on your point of view, there was or was not jurisdiction. It's a type of thing that arises in every special appearance. You have perhaps greater contacts in some cases, lesser contacts in others. You had some contacts in that case. This court chose to resolve that on the merits, despite the jurisdictional issue on the merits, despite your language about total and inarguable absence of jurisdiction. And your view, obviously, that's what you had reached. In my view, and in reading jurisdictional cases, I must respectfully disagree that that was the situation in some. I cannot put the two cases together. And with all due respect to this court, and you know that I do respect each of you, it has created a problem for the bench and bar, and it's created a problem for the Court of Appeals that they have resolved by simply denying all applications when a special appearance comes along, because they read the exception in Canadian Helicopters to be very narrow and strict. And, of course, they're not looking for more mandamus cases anyway.
Mr. Countess, is there any, if obviously in some of these writings the court is split on their view about it.
Yes.
Is there anything that prevents this court from just saying, we just think special appearance is just so important that we're going to drop the requirement of being protected on appeal and we just go straight to the merits? Is there an abuse of discretion here and decide it and just ignore the appeal? Is there anything that prevents the court from just saying 128 is just so important, we're going to treat it differently on mandamus than we treat others?
To my knowledge, there is nothing that would prevent you from doing that. Obviously, in this case, I would hope you would not do it, but let me say, as a practitioner, at least we would know precisely where we stood on that issue. And it's the last thing that I want you to do because of what it's going to do to my client in this case.
So if Canadian Helicopters created that, and National Sand put together, have created such a confusion with the bench and bar, the court has the power to change the law and overrule Canadian Helicopters.
Of course, yes. This is the policy court, and you made the policy in one case, and you can change it in another.
Why isn't this just the logical extension of KDF versus Rex, as Mr. Hartman argued, where special appearances involve comity and relationships between independent states of the United States and between the United States and foreign nations? Why didn't that sort of put an extra weight in the side of granting the writ?
Because there is no comity issue in this case, Your Honor. As Justice Baker pointed out, we're talking about a private company, not a public company, not a governmental entity. Second, the expressed interest of the Australian government that's in this record is not an expressed interest in this case. It is an expressed interest before the United States Supreme Court in a case that was out of, I believe, West Virginia. They had, and incidentally, my recollection is that the West Virginia cases were ones where they had no evidence that anything even was shipped into the state. And I'll cover that issue in a minute because I know the court will have some questions about it. But it was more tenuous by far than what we have here. So it was in a different case. And if I can go get something that somebody filed in some other lawsuit and bring it to this lawsuit and say, well, that applies here too, then we have no consistency, and we have no rules of evidence, and we have no limit to the area of concern.
Mr. Callis, let me just clarify something. Do you dispute the fact that we're talking only about one shipment of a great amount of asbestos material in 1957 to Mantua Corporation, which they took possession in Australia, and that there's been no connection, zero connection between that material shipped in 1957 to any of the plaintiffs seeking compensation for injuries due to asbestos?
I think there is a little more to it than that. Let me say first that I do not agree that that's the only basis we have to rely on the jurisdiction. I have about 10 items lined up here, and I'll, if the court wishes and gives me an opportunity, I will talk about those. But the allegation is that this plaintiff and others were exposed to the transite pipe. We know, made by JM, we know that all of the transite pipe made by JM had the blue fiber in it. This exposure that we're in question about here took place in Texas. And so some assumption can be made that the pipe was made in Texas, but we have no evidence of that. But we do have evidence, obviously, that it is transite pipe, that it contained blue fiber from Australia, that it, and that that's the source of the exposure. So that's the connection.
What other contacts are you alleging between this?
I wish I could argue specific jurisdiction, and I will, but I do it with tongue.
On what basis?
Well, I must do it with tongue in cheek. My basis is the shipment that I just mentioned, and the fact that CSR...
So your argument is specific jurisdiction comes out of what you just said, this sequence of inferences that finally this pipe caused one plaintiff's problem. Therefore, that puts CSR together with this plaintiff, and you've got jurisdiction under the specific jurisdiction requirement.
I think it's more than one plaintiff, but yes.
But your brief just said at least one.
Right. Well, and
alleges the pipe problem.
And I don't know. I don't know if we have any requirement that it be more than one, but.
So those facts lead to a conclusion that the cause of action arises directly out of the specific contact between CSR and this plaintiff.
They will lead to the conclusion that yes, they will, in this sense, that the asbestos that was the cause of the problem was the blue fiber from Australia that came from this defendant. Now, because
that's their counter-argument, so what? We sold it to them in Australia, and they took charge of it, and they took it wherever they wanted to, and they did whatever they wanted to.
Well, and that gets into my list, but let me, and I'm going to answer that in just a second. Let me complete my answer to the previous question. There is one other contact in that a CSR shipment that went to Louisiana was also sent to Texas, to Denison, Texas, where it was made in pipes.
Is that Johns Mansville again?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm sorry, would you repeat? I couldn't hear you.
There was a shipment, a second shipment that we know about that was sent to Louisiana and then shipped on from there by Johns Mansville to their plant in Denison.
Was that another FOB shipment?
I would assume that it is.
We might assume it, but do we know it?
No, we don't know. I wish I knew that it was not an FOB shipment, but the truth of the matter is FOB is immaterial. International Shoe, many, many years ago, had that very same situation. It took no note of that as being a significant jurisdictional fact. And you factor, of course, that's just one of many, and that's the problem with all of this, or perhaps the reality of all of it, is that you can't look at one fact and say, well, there it is, that's it, it's all over, in this kind of case. But here's what you have. You have a company that had a product it wanted to sell, and it wanted to sell it in the United States of America, and it worked for about 20 years to do that. It worked very, very hard to do it. It sent its people to the United States time after time after time to visit with the Johns Manville people, to tour the plants, to learn what was being made from the product. And this is all on the record. I'm not playing games with the court. To learn what was being done. You've got testimony from former JM executives saying things like, they knew what we were doing. They knew exactly what we were doing. They always discussed the use we were making of their asbestos. They wanted to find out what we were using the asbestos for. He's talking about the folks from Australia.
Mr. Countess, if I recall your brief, it's artfully crafted in the context of this happened in the United States, but I don't recall reading anywhere in there that any of these things you're talking about actually happened in Texas.
The visits did not occur in Texas, but what happened was,
isn't that kind of important to personal jurisdiction, what happened in Texas?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. And here is the next step.
In other words, couldn't you argue that, well, yes, I might be subject to jurisdiction in Kansas, But I never did anything in Texas, so you can't bring me there.
And that's exactly what's being argued.
I understand that. You don't think that's a good argument based on the United States?
No, I do not for this, for various reasons. One, it's the two shipments I mentioned. The third reason, in 1946, I believe, you'll find in the minutes of CSR, a comment about them making a selling arrangement with Johns Manville for disposal of blue asbestos in North and South America. Then, shortly thereafter, and this is under tab 7, and I believe this is exhibit 19 under tab 7 in the exhibits, you'll find a little sheet of paper prepared by Johns Manville that outlines its use of this blue transite fiber, of the transite pipe, which had always the blue fiber in it. And they talk about how it's dispersed. They talk about it being sold all over the United States, but they also, and it's for many years, they talk about it being sold for many years. And as an example, they talk about it, they say first it's sold in all 48 states. Well, that includes Texas. Then they talk about it being used in the East Texas oil fields. Now, when you combine that information, which is Johns Manville's representation, not CSR, but John Manville, that its fiber is being, its pipe is being sold in Texas with this blue fiber in it, with the testimony from former JM executives that the CSR people visited all of the plants, they knew what use was being made, they knew what was going on with the pipe, and the language varies, but the fair interpretation of the language and the factual interpretation, could be subject to several interpretations, and if we have a fact question, we don't have a Matt Davidson case, the correct interpretation, or a possible interpretation, is that they would have known, because of all of this, that their product was being used in the state of Texas.
So then that's the stream of commerce theory?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
So that's your other theory?
Well, I suppose it's part of it.
That would be your general jurisdiction theory?
Yes,
stream
correct.
Of commerce.
Correct. It's part of the general jurisdiction argument.
Did you say they visited all the plant in Texas?
No, I don't know that they visited all the plants. They visited many of the JM plants.
I have no evidence. Said that they visited all the plants.
I did not mean to say every plant JM has. If I said that, I
thought. So we're not alleging that it came to Texas in regard to it.
We have no evidence that they came to Texas. No, on any of these visits. But certainly under the stream of commerce theory, they put all of this into motion. They knew where the product was going. They knew what was happening to it. And it ended up in Texas. And the fair inference from the evidence is that they knew that from the very beginning, or at least soon thereafter. The FOB Australia, they didn't just go down and dump that in a pile somewhere. The normal FOB is if you load it on the ship.
What are the facts there concerning that ship? You say in the brief three times that CSR shipped it, and CSR says they didn't. So,
well,
we've apparently got a question about the use of the language here. So,
I guess that depends on how you define ship. To me, because FOB is not a significant jurisdictional fact, as I read international shoe, to put it on the ship, which is the normal. I mean, FOB means free on board, put it on board the ship, then to me the logical conclusion from that is if they had shipped it to the U.S.
But they didn't pay for it, I think.
No.
Title and possession to it in Australia?
There's no evidence one way or the other on that. If you can assume that from an FOB agreement, then that would be correct.
But at least what you do know from FOB is that the seller takes it to the point of departure and does not pay for the transportation beyond that point.
That is my understanding of FOB. Yes, Your Honor.
Before your time expires, Mr. Counters, I'm curious to hear about the waiver argument and what happened in oral argument in West Virginia, because there's issue's been joined,
yes,
on that.
Let me cover the first facts and then I'll try to talk a minute about the law. Factually, the allegation, and I believe this is actually in the opinion, if I recall correctly, or the statement is made, that the attorney for CSR represented to the West Virginia Supreme Court that they were not going to contest jurisdiction in states to which fiber had been directly shipped, such as Texas, and apparently Texas was specifically named. Now.
And that has been disputed by the attorney. Correct?
I'm sorry.
That has been disputed.
Yes.
He denied it.
Correct. CSR, the attorney who allegedly made the statement, and other CSR folks say, no, that didn't happen. I didn't even say it. Other folks on the other side, including court personnel, said, yes, he did say it. And
But there's nothing in writing, and there's no oral recording, audio tape of it.
That's correct, but we have affidavits or other written information from folks on both sides.
But wouldn't Rule 11 apply? That wouldn't have to be in writing and filed with court before it could be enforceable. I mean, irrespective of waiver, I mean, our Rule 11 just says you'd have to have it in writing and filed with court to have it be an issue here.
Well, yeah, I suppose if it were made in a Texas court, yes. We're not presenting it as a Rule 11 incident. In fact, to me, it has two uses. I think its primary use, even though I certainly present an argument on waiver and that sort of thing, I think its primary use is one more indication of the company's knowledge of what was going on with its products. It cannot stand back and say, gosh, we were FOB everything. We just dug it out of the ground and took it down and dumped it in the ship. We don't know what's going from there. We have no idea what it was used for. That's just not correct, and that's one more indication of that. From the standpoint of its value as either a waiver or some sort of estoppel, you simply have this. You have a conflicting or a fact question on whether a statement was made in a judicial proceeding that would have been intended to influence the outcome of that proceeding. That's the only purpose for which it could have been made. Now, the question this court would have to answer if that ever became an issue that had to be resolved is, what do you do with something like that? If I make a representation to you to try to persuade you to take a particular position or to make a particular decision, and later in some other proceeding I change and take a different or opposite position on that same matter, should I suffer any consequences? That's really the ultimate question behind this. I don't know that you have to resolve that at this point, but it is present in this case.
Do you agree with counsel that the trial court's order has put them in every case that arises?
That's the first time I've heard that argument, and I don't understand it. First of all, this went through the master asbestos docket in Harris County, which is a creature of considerable interest. I seem to spend a whole lot of my time working with it, shall we say. I can tell you from my own personal knowledge that nothing is final before the master asbestos docket. There is at least one major issue that I'm fighting right now that I thought was solved three different times. Different facts will create a different problem, and the only thing that CSR has to do is request a hearing and file the proper papers before whichever judge was in such bad disfavor with his colleagues that he got appointed the asbestos judge for that month, and go back and have another hearing on it.
You would, in essence, though, be arguing exactly the same jurisdictional facts that you're arguing here, wouldn't you?
Very likely, and unless we have been able to uncover something else, very likely.
Any other questions? Thank you.
May it please the court, a couple of points in rebuttal. It is not a fact that all transite pipe contains blue asbestos. Some is made with white asbestos. So just as I wanted to clear that up. The affidavit on file by Mr. Smith in this case establishes that the one shipment in question to the sold FOB Australia, the title, risk of loss, all of that passed. The delivery to the ship was all pursuant to the purchaser's instructions. The purchaser had made arrangements to ship it where the purchaser wanted it to go.
But it is of some relevance, isn't it, that the seller knows that it's going to a particular destination. And if you show, for example, not in this case, but shipment after shipment after shipment, even if it was FOB, you knew it was going to Texas, you could expect that there might be a problem in Texas.
I guess there are two ifs with that. One, if you adopted the most liberal view of stream of commerce and analyzing jurisdiction, but two, if you're dealing with somebody who's exposed to fiber and making a claim on that basis. What we're faced with is some finished product of what happened sometime much further down the line, some 30 or 40 years later, or something to that effect.
What about the CRS 1946 minute where it's been represented to us that they recognize that their asbestos was being used as products prevalent in East Texas oil fields?
Your Honor, that was a new one on me. Now, there's no doubt some CSR people from time to time would make sales calls, and that's when they came to the United States. I mean, John Mandel had come to them, had gotten them interested in establishing a relationship, had gone to Australia and bought this fiber, and they had people who came from time to time to doing a customer check, and that's all. But the idea that they were involved or had anything to do with, development of products or joint venturing research or anything that would get us into the kinds of cases that, in effect, make a partnership, are just not present in this case.
Do you concede the fact, as counsel argues, that shipment FOB has not had jurisdictional significance since international shoe?
I don't agree with that, Your Honor. I agree to the extent that the fact that the shipment was FOB doesn't answer all the questions. I mean, International Shoe is a case that they point to that gets into this. And of course, International Shoe, there were 11 to 13 employees set up in the forum, a payroll. I mean, there was significant involvement. And, FOB didn't drive that case. But all we've got here is one shipment to FOB, and FOB says a lot. It means when title risk of loss.
Well, you continue to refer to one shipment, and as I understood, Mr. Kansas said there were two shipments. Can you respond to that?
Justice Hightower, he said that one shipment was made to New Orleans and then later shipped and ended up in Denison, I think is what he said. I mean, that kind of makes my point. I mean, this was out of our control. If in fact some fiber ended up in Denison that had been transshipped by Johns Manvel, I mean, that's up to Johns Manvel. And that's the anomaly of our position. In effect, we're being called upon to defend injuries that are claimed from products made by this long bankrupt company a long time ago. I mean, when our only involvement was selling the raw fiber to Johns Manville.
But is there not evidence in the record that you knew your fiber was being incorporated in Johns Manville products that went into Texas? Is there evidence to that effect or not?
Your Honor, it's fair to say that the CSR knew that its fiber was being used in Johns Manville products.
That came into Texas. And you knew that those products were being...
That is not in the record. There's nothing in the record to that effect. If it pleases the court, we are not opening the floodgates by urging this mandamus petition today. We're talking about conduct that took place almost 40 years ago. Shipping by Johns Manville, not us. Claims that CSR is liable for products made by the Johns Manville that was bankrupt a long time ago. The objections by the Australian government, I think, is a substantial issue before the court. And this court acknowledged in English China.
May I ask you a question? If you follow that argument out, any company that's in another state, even in this United States, could say, if I got a friend in the legislature, we'll get them to write a letter and say, Kansas or whoever objects to Texas jurisdiction, and you got your argument.
Well, Your Honor, if the request is just to deal with this fairly, not to expand your law and try to haul our companies into a foreign venue.
But isn't that this state's jurisdictional system right to make those decisions? And I'm not saying we make them right all the time, but isn't that our right, instead of having a foreign jurisdiction, say, don't make that decision at all because this is one of our people?
It absolutely is the duty of this court.
Well, if you make it, you've got to make it the way we want you to make it. Now, that's a little problem, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it is because, I mean, English China is an example. I mean, it was decided there that the minimum contacts were satisfied, but jurisdiction was not invoked on a fairness and equitable basis, taking a look at the foreign nature of the companies and the rest of it. Asahi the same way. And all we're saying is
let's be sure that we don't use the long-arm jurisdiction ability to such an extent to drag aliens before the court in a way that would be unfair to them. Treat them fairly and equitably. I mean, Australia doesn't have a stream of commerce theory, and that's what their government said in the pleading that's before the court. And they're saying, and neither does the United States, of course, incidentally, but all they're saying is don't enmesh our major companies in your courts and in mass tort litigation in this instance in Texas if there's not an adequate basis for it. And this particular case would be a reach to drag CSR before the court and require it to answer in this asbestos litigation.
Well, but that goes to the merits and the issue. Is this a mandamusable situation under this court's rules? And we have Canadian on one side and sand on the other, and that seems to be where the line is drawn, in the sand, so to speak. and it's a disturbing situation.
It is, Your Honor, but I guess unless you take the position that you can never have, let's say, an alien corporation that's dragging one of our mass tort cases with no jurisdiction, let's just put aside all everything we've been talking about on whether, you know, CSR's facts are sufficient to invoke, you know, the extreme standards that we've been talking about, with no basis for jurisdiction, and they're not successful in getting the trial lower courts to let them out of the case, and they're instead told that you're going to have to follow your normal remedies on appeal up through the chain, and they're going to follow Johns Manville right to where they ended up. I mean, because of those companies with the defense costs and the, you know, the thousands and tens of thousands of plaintiffs that are naming them, in my, for instance, with no basis whatsoever, there's got to be some level at which you would say we will entertain mandamus in that extreme kind of a case. We won't make this alien corporation, you know, a valued ally of the United States, a valued trading partner.
Well,
it won't suck them dry.
Is that a fair balance, though, when the special exception is sustained and the plaintiff then has to go through an appeal with totally different standards of review?
Well, I mean, in this case, of course, we have plaintiffs that have got plenty of people to sue, and they've got plenty of defendants. If the plaintiffs overreach in such a way that if they hit the extreme example that I'm talking about, I'm really not too much bothered by the equity of the plaintiff's situation. I mean, if they've hit the inarguable basis for jurisdiction standard, then they should have, they should look a little more carefully at the outset as to who they were making defendants in the case.
Any other questions? Thank you. The court will take another brief recess.
Please rise.